The title of the lesson is A Very Little Thing. Luke uses this expression in his gospel three times and is used in reference to spiritual concerns. And as you think about that expression, a very little thing, and think that it refers to, you know, spiritual matters or even the commandments of God, it raises a question perhaps in your mind as to what might properly be regarded as a very little thing. Now, to some extent, we can imagine that this expression accommodates human thinking. That is, we are prone to think that some commandments of God are smaller or greater in relation to others. As a matter of fact, for instance, in John 19, verse 11, Jesus told Pilate that those who had delivered him up to Pilate had the greater sin. So there are greater sins, so there would be lesser sins. You would think then that there would be greater commandments and lesser commandments. We'll talk about that more. But, you know, the concept I want to point out does have something to commend for it in the scriptures. And yet, we need to realize that nothing in the scriptures says that even what we might regard as the little things may be ignored or disobeyed with impunity. And basically that's what the lesson is about today. It's stressing the importance of meticulous obedience in the things of God, obeying all of God's commandments, not thinking that some commandments of God, some spiritual concerns, are too small to warrant our attention. That there are relatively little things in the Bible does raise the question of their importance, and it raises the larger question of the role of obedience in relation to grace and our salvation. Does obedience, particularly in what we might regard as these little things, have anything to do with our salvation? Believe it or not, there are some who would say, no, not absolutely. It's common in the Protestant or evangelical world for people to believe that really it's nice, it's a good thing, you should obey all of God's laws, but you don't really have to in order to go to heaven. And some brethren in their thinking, or at least in the way they speak, lead me to believe that maybe they approach that thinking also. So there are questions that this reference to the little things can raise in our minds. Is it important to God whether his people are mindful of a very little thing? Or is that something that it's all right with him if we dismiss? We might even go back farther and say, how do we know what a very little thing is? What is it? How do we identify it? I mean, what one person may think is a commandment that, you know, we really don't have to obey or be, or something is too little for us to be concerned about. Another person might not. So how do we come to agreement on what these very little things are? You know, it would be easy to answer that question if the Bible said something, and this is really what my lesson is about today too. You know, this is a very little thing. This is not a very little thing. This is a big thing. If God would just kind of categorize his commandments according to size and importance and just say or at least imply that, you know, the ones in the lowest category, the very little things, well, you really don't have to do that. But, again, the point of my lesson is God doesn't do that, does he? You know, and this brings us to the matter of the relationship between grace and obedience in our salvation. There's long been a tension, whether real or just perceived, in people's minds about the relationship between grace and obedience. Are we saved by grace, or are we saved by obedience, or we saved by both? Well, the Bible teaches that we're saved by both. Bible says that we cannot be saved by obedience apart from grace, Ephesians 2, verse 8, for by grace have you been saved through faith. And then in the next verse, verse 9, goes on to say, not as a result of works that no one should boast. So you might, people gather from that, that, okay, works or obedience don't play a role ultimately in our salvation. Again, some people have the idea, you know, obedience, it's nice, but it's really icing on the cake, so to speak. But then on the other hand, it says in Hebrews 5, verse 9, that Christ became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. So that and similar scriptures teach that we cannot be saved without obedience. So there's always been that tension between, in the minds of people at least, if not a conflict in the minds of people, between grace and obedience in relation to our salvation. So that people have viewed the relationship between grace and obedience as if they were, you know, conversely proportional. Now, what do I mean by conversely proportional? Well, I simply mean that some people think that giving proper stress to grace requires them to give that much less stress to obedience. And the more you stress, the converse would be true, the more you stress obedience, well, the less stress you're giving to, or less importance you're attaching to, grace. It's like, you know, grace and obedience are incompatible with one another. They're in conflict with one another. That's the human perception of it anyway. And as a matter of fact, some would go so far in stressing grace that, now, and this is the extreme, that they would go so far as, may I throw a big word on you, antinomianism. Anti, the prefix anti means against. The root of the word nomianism comes from the Greek word nomos, which means law. So antinomianism is the concept that law is bad. It's a bad thing. You need to get rid of it or just ignore it. And the more you emphasis you put on the law, the worse it is. And so some would go all the way to the extreme of saying, well, if we're saved by grace, then we don't need to be concerned about law at all. Now, that's an extreme. Most people would not go that far. But some have. Some have. Even back in the first century, some got that impression. Let me just read a few scriptures to you along that line from Romans. Romans 3, verse 8 has Paul saying, and why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come. Their condemnation is just. And then in chapter 6, verse 1, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace might increase? First part of verse 2 has Paul's answer to that. May it never be. And then verse 15, what then? Shall we sin because we are not under law but under grace? Again, he says, may it never be. So I'm just, for one thing, trying to point out that, yes, some people did hold this extreme view that since we're saved by grace, there's really no place for law and obedience to law in our lives as Christians. Now, to be sure, probably there are very, very, very few people who claim to be Christians who would say that. The problem is, though, some take varying steps toward that position. They don't go all the way there. And some of these steps are very small, relatively small anyway, and may even be subtle. But in their nature, they are antinomian, or they are opposed to law, or the idea that we need to be obedient to the law. Now, those who diminish obedience in order to exalt grace might think that they find support in a couple of stories from the life of Jesus. For instance, the story of the rich young ruler who approached Jesus, wanting to know what he had to do to inherit eternal life. In Matthew 19, beginning with verse 16, it says, "And behold, one came to him and said, 'Teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may obtain eternal life?' And he said to him, 'Why are you asking me about what is good? There is only one who is good, but if you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments.'" Let me pause right there and make a point. Here's somebody coming to Jesus and asking him what he needs to do to be saved. Now, surely, even at that point, I mean, even during the Old Testament period or when the Old Testament was in effect, people were still saved by grace. They weren't saved by law per se or law keeping per se. But nevertheless, what does Jesus say to him? If you wish to enter into life, do what? Keep or obey the commandments. Now, it's interesting to me, and we need to emphasize this, that even the Lord here very plainly, very specifically said, you know, you want to be saved? You've got to keep the commandments. But reading on, he said to him, "Which ones?" Let me pause again. See, this is where the idea of some things being little things, some parts of God's law, some commandments not being as big or as great as others, and the implication being maybe you don't need to keep all of them, particularly the little ones, as they might be thought of. So he says, "Which ones?" As if we've got a choice, right? Now, we as Christians ought to recognize that is ridiculous. That's really is ridiculous. Jesus said, "Keep the commandments," and then he seems to have this idea. Well, which ones do I need to keep? As though you know there are some I don't need to keep. And Jesus goes on. Let me save a little bit of time by quoting several of the commandments of the famous Ten Commandments. And at the end of verse 19, ends up by saying, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," which is not one of the Ten Commandments. But nevertheless, what Jesus in another place calls the second greatest law. And he says, the rich young ruler says, "All these things I've kept. What am I still lacking?" And Jesus said to him, "If you wish to be complete, go and sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." Now, when the man asked Jesus, "Which ones? Which one of the commandments do I need to keep in order to have eternal life?" And Jesus, instead of saying what I said a moment ago, that's a bad question. You should keep all of the commandments. Instead, Jesus starts citing particular commandments. Most of them here from the Ten Commandments. And some people might gather from that, see, he's pointing out here that it's really the moral commandments and love, loving your neighbor as yourself. That's true, that are very important. But what they draw from that is that the others, what might be thought of as the non-moral commandments, okay, you don't need to be so concerned about keeping them. Well, that's a false idea, because you've got to ask, how do you love your neighbor? How do you love your neighbor? Okay, the commandment is love your neighbors yourself. But stop to think about that for just a moment. How do you love your neighbor, and how do you know you're loving your neighbor? That brings in the importance of what might be thought of as the lesser, what people think of as the lesser commandments. You can't know how to love your neighbor. You don't know if you love your neighbor unless you love him through keeping those lesser commandments, what might be thought of as the lesser commandments that relate to him and your relationship with him. Now, as an example of that, in order to establish that, let me first of all make reference to Matthew 10, verse 42. Where Jesus speaks of a cup of cold water. Now, how much does a cup of cold water cost? Not very much today. Now, it might have cost more back then because you might have to run half a mile to the well and, you know, lower the bucket to get a cup of cold water and bring it back. So it might have been a little bit more costly. for a cup of water back in Jesus' day than now. But still, nevertheless, the point is, it's a relatively small thing. Jesus says in Matthew 10, verse 42, "And whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward." The reward is dependent upon you doing something like giving a cup of cold water to a thirsty man or woman. I would think that most people would think of it, that is a small thing. I love that. Giving somebody a cup of cold water. But Jesus puts importance on that. You need to be willing to do something like that. If you're going to get your reward, that is, if you're going to be saved. And another example from the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 22. Now here the Lord, through Moses, gets into some matters that we might consider to be pretty ordinary, pretty mundane. Well, just starting with verse 1 of Deuteronomy 22, you'll see that it says, "You shall not see your countrymen's ox or sheep straying away and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countrymen. If your countryman is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall remain with you until your countryman looks for it. Then you shall restore it to him. And thus you shall do with his donkey, and you shall do the same with his garment, and you shall do likewise with anything lost by your countrymen, which he has lost and you have found. You are not allowed to neglect them. You shall not see your countrymen's donkey or his ox falling down on the way and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly help him to raise him up." And by the way, I don't have this scripture here, but Exodus 23 verses 4 and 5 has a similar statement, a similar law that says, if your enemy's ox or donkey is in trouble, or if the person you hate has an ox or donkey in trouble, he's not around and you are, nevertheless, just because he's your enemy, just because you hate him because theoretically he's done some things bad to you, that does not excuse you from helping out the ox or the donkey of your enemy or the one you hate. Now, my point here is, some people might say, mundane things here. Do we really need to be concerned about, you know, picking things up after our neighbor? You know, if he drops a coin or whatever, we return it to him, or, you know, his donkey or sheep or his ox. You know, of course, those things were more valuable then. I understand. But my point is, how do we obey the biggest commands, love the Lord our God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength, and the second, to love our neighbors ourselves, unless we look at what we might think are the little commandments and obey them? And again, that was the problem with the rich young ruler we looked at a moment ago in Matthew, the 19th chapter. Apparently, he had not paid attention to what he might have thought of as the lesser commandments. He said, I've done these things, including love my neighbors yourself. Have you really? You're rich? And all these poor people are out here? Have you really loved your poor neighbor as you should? If you've allowed yourself to live in power and luxury without doing more than you've done to help your poor neighbor? So apparently he had not kept the commandments of God. He had not loved his neighbor as himself. So again, my general point is, we keep the big, what we might think of as the big important commandments, by keeping the not so important commandments, or what we think are not so important. So, point is, we can't afford even to ignore the small things. We need to try to be meticulous in our service to God and in our obedience to His commandments. It's a bad attitude to say, well, I know God said this, but, you know, I really don't think really don't think that's a big deal to God. No, that's a bad attitude to begin with. Okay, let me move on from that in the interest of saving some time and getting to some examples from the Old and New Testaments. Yeah. I want to compare obedience in the Old Testament with obedience in the New Testament. I mean, was it the case that in either the Old nor the New Testament that God didn't really expect people to keep his small commandments, the very little things? When we go to the scriptures, what do we find out about that? Well, actually, there were sins that people might have considered to be little sins, but they were punished for those, their disobedience. Even in regard to what we might consider those little things. For instance, and I'm going to go quickly through some of these examples because I want to spend longer on a few others of them. The first sin. Some people might think, fruit eating? Really? Fruit eating? That was the focus of the first sin? I mean, is that really such a big deal? Some people might think, but yeah, Adam and Eve got ousted from the Garden of Eden for, well, I know that the implications of it are much bigger than this. I understand that. But the specific violation of God's law was that they were not to eat of certain tree, and they did. But fruit eating, we would think that's a small thing. Second example, Nadab and Abihu, two sons of Aaron, the first high priest. They were priests themselves. Let's turn to Leviticus 10, verses 1 through 3, and I don't want to spend long on this one because if you've heard me preaching for very long, you've probably heard me cite this passage for quite a few times. But it says, beginning with verse 1 of Leviticus 10, now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Now, some people might say, well, okay. They acted on their own initiative. They acted without the authority of God. They offered strange fire, and that strange fire is the fire which he had not commanded them. He had not said, don't do this at this point. He had not said, do this at this point. They just decided, hey, good idea at this point. Let's offer this fire. Or burn this incense at this point. Well, regardless of what we might think, the point is, their infraction of God's procedures here was enough to get them burned alive. The third example now. This might stun some people. According to Numbers 15, verses 32 through 36, the Israelites caught a man out gathering wood on the Sabbath day. Well, you know what happened to him? God said, take him out and stone him to death. And that's what happened. Now, this might seem to be kind of harsh here. I mean, fire and gathering wood for a fire were pretty important matters in those days. That's how people cooked their food. That's how they got warm and so forth. And they needed fire. Fire was a pretty important element in their lives. Actually, it still is today. And he was out gathering wood. I don't know why he would have been out gathering wood on the Sabbath day other than to make a fire on the Sabbath day. In order to appreciate the nature of this infraction, though, the fact that it was brazen, in Exodus 35, verses 1 through 3, we need to know what it says there. Then Moses assembled all the congregation of the sons of Israel and said to them, these are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. Any questions? And then to make sure he's not understood, notice the next words in verse 3. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. So apparently this man, assuming that he knew that law, and he should have, just thought, well, picking up sticks, make a fire on the Sabbath day, no big deal, small thing, little thing, I can afford to ignore this. Well, he found out the Israelites did too. No, you can't afford to ignore what you might regard as a little law of God. In Exodus 4, verses 24 through 26, to cite the fourth example, this might seem surprising to some. God almost killed Moses because he failed to circumcise his son. Now, going all the way back to Abraham, in Genesis, the 17th chapter, God had decreed that Abraham and all his descendants and all in his house, and this was incorporated into the law of Moses, were to circumcise their male children on the eighth day of their lives. Now, let me just observe to you that that doesn't sound like a big deal. Not to be crude here, but you got to consider that the foreskin of an eight day old baby boy can't be very big. Pretty small. Okay, we're not talking about a big deal here. Okay, physically speaking, except perhaps to the little baby boy. Now, nevertheless. And as a matter of fact, there were times we can say, Moses ignored this law, by the way. He ignored the law. And later on, as a matter of fact, when the Israelites were traveling through the wilderness, they ignored this law because we're told in Joshua, the 5th chapter, verses 1 through 9, that God commanded all the Israelites who had come out of Egypt and had survived the years in the wilderness, they had to circumcise themselves and their children upon entering into the land of Canaan because they had ignored the law. They'd ignore the law. So apparently there were Israelites thinking, including Moses, thinking this is not a big deal. But God almost killed Moses over this. Almost killed him. So though circumcision was a small matter, and God was sending Moses on an important mission, nevertheless, God interrupted the whole mission. And he was on an important mission. This is when he's going back to Egypt to bring the Israelites out of Egyptian bondage. God almost killed him nevertheless. Because why? He had not circumcised his son. Next example. And this again belongs to the life of Moses. God did not allow Moses to enter Canaan because he struck a rock to bring forth water for the Israelites instead of simply speaking to it as God had said. Now, we might look at Moses' mistake here and say, okay, he struck the rock instead of speaking to it. Okay, is that really? I mean, water came forth anyway. There was a similar example of this back in Exodus 17 when God did tell Moses to strike the rock to bring forth water. So he changes one word here, from speak to strike, from strike to speak. And did he really expect Moses to pay attention to a change in one word in his instructions? Well, apparently so. Now, there were other problems here, that seemed to excuse Moses' disobedience. I mean, the Israelites had been provoking him for about 40 years here. You ever been exasperated with people? I imagine we've all had that experience in our lives. Well, Moses had been putting up with the Israelites in the wilderness, and they're complaining for 40 years. And he's just about had enough of it. Now, we're told about this in Psalm 106, verses 32 and 33. It says, "There it went hard on Moses because of them," or on their account. In other words, the Israelites pushed him into this. In a moment of frustration and exasperation, this is a lesson for us, by the way, because we're pretty weak when we get angry. Anger is not a good thing. Generally speaking for us. Because it's at those moments when Satan can work on us and get us to do and say things we shouldn't do and say. And so it was with Moses. Some people might say, that's a small thing, though, to keep him out of the land of Canaan. Well, God didn't think so. In 1 Samuel 6, verses 13 through 21, God struck some men of the city of Beth Shemesh because they looked into the ark. Now, they were not supposed to do this. Nevertheless, they had, here the ark of the covenant is coming back from the Philistines who had had it for a while, coming back on an ox cart from the Philistines. It stopped there near the city of Beth Shemesh. And the text tells us that the people received the ark with gladness and they offered up sacrifices. They worshiped God on the occasion. It was a happy occasion. But yet some of them, I don't know if their curiosity got the best of them or what, but even though they weren't supposed to, they looked into the ark. Now, God's instructions about this in Numbers 151 and Numbers 4, verses 4 through 20, were pretty clear about this. Later on, according to 2 Samuel 6, verses 1 through 7, God killed a man by the name of Uzzah because he touched the ark because he thought it needed to be steadied, else it might fall. Now, some people might think, you know, these are not big infractions. These do not warrant the death sentence. But God had been very specific about this. The priests were to go in, before the tabernacle was moved, priests were to go into it, cover up all of the furniture, including the Ark of the Covenant, so that it could not be seen or touched by the Levites or any of the other people, lest they die. God was very clear about this. Now, some people might think, yeah, this, yeah, not a big deal. God thought it was. 1 Samuel 15 has God ordering Saul, King Saul, to go and slay all of the Amalekites and all of their livestock. Well, if you read the text, you can see there that Samuel or Saul was at least 99% there in his obedience. I mean, he only saved the king Agag, one person, and kept the best of the livestock to sacrifice to the Lord, so he said. And as a matter of fact, he claimed, when he was confronted by Samuel, he said, I did obey the voice of the Lord. So his thinking was, you know, if you do it 99% of the way, that's as good as 100% of the way. Well, God didn't think so. He said, to obey is better than sacrifice. Now, the next two are particularly interesting. Might spend a little bit more time on them. 2 Chronicles 36, verses 20 and 21. That's the last chapter in 2 Chronicles. The Babylonians have come down and they've laid siege to Jerusalem. And as a matter of fact, they take the city of Jerusalem and take the people off, at least those who have not been killed, take them off into Babylonian exile. Now, the people had been really bad, grossly idolatrous, you know, had been guilty of bloodshed and all of that. But despite their long persistence in idolatry and other sins, I want you to notice the basis that is given for their going off into exile. In verses 20 and 21. And those who had escaped from the sword, he carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the reign or rule of the kingdom of Persia. To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, it kept Sabbath, until 70 years were complete. Now, the 70 years were referred to a couple of times in the book of Jeremiah. But notice the specific reason here that is cited for them being swept off their land into exile, so that the land would enjoy its Sabbaths. Now, the background for that command is found in Leviticus 25 and 26. Now, God had told the Israelites every seventh day, that is on the Sabbath, weekly Sabbath, you're not to work. Not only that, but every seventh year and every 50th year, the latter being the year of Jubilee, as it was called, the Israelites were not to till their soil. They were not to grow any crops. They were not to tend their vineyards. They were not to tend their olive orchards and so on. Now, that might not seem like a big deal, but of course, to an agricultural society, that was a big deal. You know, we think about people because of COVID-19, small business owners going out of business because they don't have customers coming in, to pay for their services or products. And it's really hard on people because they basically can't work. A lot of people have suffered for, 7 months or so because of that? 7 or 8 months? Now, imagine a society in which is basically composed of farmers, and you tell the farmers, okay, every seventh day you can't work, and every seventh year throughout the year you basically can't work, and every 50th year you can't work. 2 years in a row, as a matter of 49th and 50th years, for 2 years in a row, they could not work, basically. Now, that's going to try your faith. Because they've got to say, I'm a farmer. How are I and my family going to eat if I don't grow crops? And as a matter of fact, in one part of his law, God addressed that very point. But for right now, let me observe to you that here was a statute of God in Leviticus 25 and 26, telling them they basically couldn't work. At least the farmers could work at these times, and no one could work on this during the seventh day of the week. But here's the point. Was that important? I get the impression that the Israelites didn't think so. Never. Now, you can bring it to my attention if you find a place, but I don't read where the Israelites ever observed the sabbatical year, every seventh year. Ever observed the year of Jubilee. And they sometimes, I think, had a tough time with observing the Sabbath. And so they might have gotten the impression, okay, that was a law given 800 to 900 years ago. God's never done anything to us yet for not keeping it. We're okay. Not so. God remembered that they had violated that law over almost 1,000 years, apparently. And they finally had to pay up for their disobedience to that law, so that the land enjoyed its Sabbath rest. Okay, next example. Interesting example, too. In Nehemiah's time, about 440 B.C., the Jews kept the law, the Feast of Booths. Now, the Feast of Booths was something that they were supposed to keep. They were supposed to go out and cut leafy branches off trees and make themselves booths, or what we would think of as huts. Some people might think of them as brush arbors, to shade them, okay? And were to do that for 7 days. Those instructions are in Leviticus 23. Verses 39 to 44, because that's how they had to live. Those are the kinds of shelters that they had when they were passing for 40 years through the wilderness toward the land of Canaan. So God said, I want you to remember this time and how your ancestors had to live. And you're going to have to live that way 7 days out of the year during what's called the Feast of Booths. Well, maybe I shouldn't laugh, but it's so ridiculous. Here are people who think, yeah, God doesn't really mean that. How do we know that? Well, Nehemiah chapter 8, verses 14 through 18. I think this is pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. Now, by the way, Nehemiah now is living about 1,000 years, 900 or 1,000 years after this law about the Feast of Booths was given. In the intervening years, how often have the Israelites obeyed this law? Possibly zero. How do we know that? Well, let's read, beginning with Nehemiah 8, verse 14. And they found, written in the law, how the Lord had commanded through Moses that the sons of Israel should live in booths during the feast of the seventh month. Now, let me pause there and make a point. You know, some laws get obsolete. Nobody pays attention to them. I understand that with respect to civil laws. Perhaps that was the attitude of the Israelites in this occasion. Okay, we read this, but really, nobody has done this. It's an obsolete law. Obviously, it's not important. That was not the attitude of the Israelites in Nehemiah's day, though. It says, beginning with verse 15, so they proclaimed and circulated a proclamation in their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go out to the hills and bring olive branches and wild olive branches, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of other leafy trees to make booths as it is written. So the people went out and brought them and made booths for themselves, each on his roof and in their courts and in the courts of the house of God and in the square of the water gate and in the square of the gate of Ephraim. And the entire assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and lived in them. The sons of Israel had indeed not done so from the days of Joshua the son of Nun to that day. And there was great rejoicing. The days of Joshua, that goes back to about the time the law was given. Basically what this means is that in the 1,000 intervening years, the Israelites had never obeyed this law. Is that the attitude of Nehemiah and his people? No. They read it. And their thinking is, God wrote it. He must mean it. So that's what we're going to do. Even though their people had apparently never done it or had not done it for a long, long time. So, the expectation of obedience did not change from the Old to the New Testament. Okay. Some people might think, okay, doesn't John 1 say the law came through Moses, but grace and truth by Jesus Christ? Yes, it does. But that doesn't mean there was no grace in Moses' time. It doesn't mean that there is no law under Christ. What we see from Jesus is that nothing has changed. That is, in terms of obedience. Now, sure, there are not nearly as many physical details that we have to pay attention to, you know, how to sacrifice animals and so forth under the new covenant. Granted. But the point is this, whatever law God has given, he's meant us to keep it. Jesus, for instance, said in Matthew 5, verse 19, during his sermon on the mount, whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments, and so teaches others, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. It's interesting to note that when Jesus cleansed lepers on a couple of occasions, what did he say? Go show yourself to the priest. Why did he do that? Because Leviticus 14, verse 2 said that's what a cleansed leper was supposed to do. And he didn't say something like, well, since this is a case of miraculous healing from the Lord, you don't have to observe that part of the commandment. No, Jesus said, reaching back to Leviticus 14, verse 2, says, now do as law says. Go and show yourself to the priest. Such was Jesus' respect for what people might consider even to be the small things. Then, of course, in Luke 16, verse 10, he emphasizes the importance of very little things. Luke 16, verse 10. There it says, he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. You can be unrighteous in a very little thing. And if you're unrighteous, this is important, if you're unrighteous in a very little thing, then incrementally, you're going to increase your disobedience and your unrighteousness, because people are prone to say, if I don't have to obey this law of God, then why do I have to obey this one? And if I don't have to obey this one, then why do I have to obey that one? That's human thinking. In conclusion, the New Testament, as I've said, has far less detail in it. I understand that. But what has never changed from the Old Testament to the New Testament is obedience, or the need for obedience. God never told any to whom he was giving the law that he did not expect, really expect them to keep that law. Indeed, it's difficult to find in the Old or New Testaments anything which diminishes, as we've seen, the seriousness of disobedience or gives to anyone the license to ignore any of God's laws. No concept of God's grace can be correct without including the critical importance of obedience to all that God has said, even in a very little thing. God's grace certainly requires a proper concept of obedience. I mean to say that we should not think that we merit our salvation by our obedience to God's will. So God's grace does require us to have a proper concept of the role of obedience in our salvation and not shut out the need for grace. But nevertheless, that proper concept of God's grace is misunderstood, or that concept of God's grace is misunderstood if we begin to think that it means less obedience. Thank you.